The following recording may contain explicit language. I can't get more explicit than may. Let's just say it may. It's Tuesday, February 26, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The beer industry wanted to get together for an industry-wide feel-good campaign because what makes you feel better than beer? Well, beer's number 2 and 3 out of 10. Bud Light, Coors Light, Miller Light, all the big boys of little beer. Beer share of the U.S. alcohol market has slipped to around 45.5%, and that's down from 56% in 1999. The light beer share of alcohol is still only around 4%, and that has held steady, except when Michelob Ultra crashed into the market with their, well, I don't have the exact percent, it's like 5-0 duels. So here's what happened. Bud took out the Super Bowl ads, you probably saw them, making fun of the cornstarch in the beers of their rivals. How dare you call our crap beer? We will no longer join you in trying to trick America into having a strong positive association with fairly weak beer. It is sad when a cartel can't get their lies together, isn't it? Now, I gotta say, as a beer lover, I have no interest in getting beer as a category more accepted. The beer that I drink, which is to say beer with some taste, and not necessarily fancy schmancy beer. Give me a Sierra Nevada. Give me a Sam Adams. Great beer available almost everywhere. But the beer that they sell in these industry-wide campaigns, different kind of beer. I often drink, by the way, I drink a Coors Light. I drink a Bud Light after a workout. I like it. It's great. In fact, it gets me nicely going onto a tastier beer. Is it a gateway beer? More like an on-ramp of beer. But I have no interest in culture-wide positivity over beer in general when most beer is this not great beer. It's like when the anchors of the news celebrate democracy in general, but the specific occasion is the Trump inauguration. In both cases, what I want to do is reach for the strong stuff. On the show today, I spiel about, a tricky area, reparations. But first, we talk so much about expanding the franchise, but not in a really fundamental way. We overlook this. The voting age. 18 once seemed unthinkable. Now it's a civic good. Well, why not 16? When I was 16, I was an informed voter. I liked Mario Cuomo, and I thought Jesse Helms was a creep. Was I wrong? Should I have been denied a vote? Up next, an Oregon legislator who wants to lower the voting age to 16.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Kids, what's the matter with kids these days? I have a theory. It's that they're disenfranchised. I don't mean just in a general abstract sense. I mean, by law, you got to be 18 to vote. Why? Why is that? Well, it doesn't have to be. In fact, any state can change the law for themselves. And a state senator in Oregon is trying to do just that. Shamia Fagan is championing legislation that will extend the vote to, I believe, 16-year-olds. Is that Senator Fagan? Hello. Is that the age that you've targeted?
16 and 17-year-olds. Yes.
Right. Yes. Yes. I wouldn't assume there'd be a gap there.
We're not going to skip over 17-year-olds. You can vote at 16 and then again at 18.
Yeah. How long have you had this idea?
So I was running for election last spring in a Democratic primary. And so I was out knocking doors when the Parkland shooting happened. And it was really fascinating to watch those students, many of them who were not yet eligible to vote in Florida, but really lead a movement that was more successful in moving the policy conversation for the President of the United States, Marco Rubio in Florida, and many members of Congress than many organizations of, you know, currently voting age adults have been able to do over the past decade. And so when I was out canvassing, I really heard kind of a movement amongst at least the folks I was talking to really consider enfranchising 16 and 17 year olds and giving them the opportunity. And so then I, throughout the rest of the election, when I would go into high schools or even middle schools, I would pose this question and just gotten incredibly informed and thoughtful responses from this very population to whom I'd like to extend the vote.
Right. So the 26th Amendment was the one that lowered the voting age in America from 21 to 18, lowered the federal voting age. And in fact, it was an Oregon case that was part of the impetus for the 26th Amendment. But the law is, you tell me, any what state municipality can define its own voting age? How would that work?
So definitely. So the 26th Amendment, and you're right, it was in the 1970s, primarily in a response to the fact that people that were 18 were being drafted to the Vietnam War, and yet they didn't have an opportunity to participate. And so Congress actually passed a law enfranchising 18-year-olds, and good old Oregon sued, saying, no, you can't just enfranchise, you know, 18-year-olds via Congress. And so then that was Oregon v. Mitchell was the case. And then, yes, the 26th Amendment was passed. And if I remember correctly, I believe that it was actually the highest kind of percentage of support for a constitutional amendment in modern history, maybe ever. The 26th Amendment says you can't disenfranchise anybody on account of age who is 18 or older. So, for example, you couldn't say Oregon's going to change the voting age to 19 or 20. But there's no prohibition whatsoever that you can lower it. In fact, a few cities across the U.S., particularly the D.C. area, have lowered the voting age in their cities for local elections. But there's certainly nothing prohibiting a state like Oregon's trying to do from lowering the voting age for every election.
Yeah. So how does this break down in your state? Who's against it? I would assume since being Democrats skews with youth, there'd be Republican opposition.
Correct. So the Senate Republican leader, so we have a majority of Democrats in the Oregon State Senate. So the minority leader, the Republican minority leader, immediately sent out a press release saying that he opposes it. And I think revealed a lot more about him than about the potential voters by immediately seeing it as a plot to earn more Democratic votes, which I just think is unfortunate that a conservative, that we've moved to a point where the conservative ideology, whether it's, you know, the state Senate leader or excuse me, the Republican leader in the Oregon State Senate or Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor, when he was talking about how we can't make Election Day a federal holiday because that's just a plot by Democrats to get more votes. We now have a political ideology that is overtly saying we don't want everybody to vote because they won't vote for us because our ideas aren't, you know, supporting them and they won't find our ideas persuasive. And so that's certainly the response that we've seen here in Oregon. The majority of the response that I've received online has been incredibly negative. And I think ironically so, if I could actually share a few of these with you. Let's see. So just a couple of the comments I've received. Shamia Fagan wants to make students today her latex salesman. I'm not even sure what that means. Here's another one. Why have age limits to anything? Who is She Man? Which I'm assuming is a reference to my appearance. Calls me a disease liberal. Somebody else calls me a cunt. And another one says that I'm a degenerate and then poop emoji, like the poop with the googly eyes.
Right.
So I think it's very interesting that these are the comments, Mike, from the quote unquote adults who are concerned about whether or not 17-year-olds and 16-year-olds have the maturity to vote.
Yeah. You'd know it wasn't a kid who sent you that poop emoji because their emoji game is much stronger than just the poop.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The emoji is like so 2016.
Very basic, yeah. I would suppose, okay, so those are some horrible calumnies, as a matter of fact. But I would suppose that there would be the regular opposition arguments against it. I've heard some. And they rely on the fact that, yes, a 16-year-old's brain is not as developed as an 18-year-old. But, of course, there's a lot of neuroscientists that says brains are really still developing until we're 24. And it does seem to me that arguments about maturity are stand-ins for disenfranchising people that aren't allowed. For instance, if you talk about maturity, if you talk about intelligence, if you talk about life experience, once someone gets over the age of 18, you can't make those arguments. It's just they become a proxy when you're under the age of 18.
Sure. And not only a proxy for that, but what about, you know, we're not going to disenfranchise adults with developmental disabilities. We're not going to disenfranchise folks who are elderly who maybe start to lose some of their faculties, right? So voting, I think that really what I've seen in this debate, because Oregon's also been a leader on other voting rights. We were the first in the nation to do vote by mail.
Yeah.
We have some of the highest election turnouts across the state or across the country, excuse me. We don't need to make Election Day a holiday because Oregonians can vote for up to 3 weeks before an election by just mailing in their ballot or dropping it off at the library. And so we also were the first state back in 2015 to pass automatic voter registration that's now in about a dozen states, where we follow an opt-out model of voter registration as opposed to opt-in. And so I think there's certainly a debate going in this country that was subtext for a while but is becoming text, which is there's folks who believe that voting is a privilege that you earn by being informed enough to vote conservatively. And, you know, you don't have enough life experience, you haven't paid enough taxes, you haven't done all these things yet to be able to be informed enough to vote conservatively.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are folks, and I am in these second group, who believe that voting is a right, that you have a right to consent to your government. And it is on people like me who want to be state senators or people that want to be members of Congress or governors or presidents to don't go out and earn the privilege of representing you. And that means that we should let everybody vote and not everybody who's eligible, of course, a citizen, et cetera, but not disenfranchising people because we're afraid they won't vote with us. But we have to go out and earn their support and earn the right to represent them.
Why do you think Oregon has been so expansive in voting rights? It is more liberal than conservative or more Democratic than Republican, but not like Massachusetts, not starkly so. And yet your state is on the forefront of allowing more people to vote more easily. What's the dynamic there?
Well, really, it was back in the 1990s when our then Secretary of State, Phil Kiesling, came up with this idea of vote by mail. And so really, I mean, before then, I don't know that Oregon had been doing a lot. In fact, as we mentioned earlier in the show, Oregon v. Mitchell was the case of Oregon suing the federal government to not have to enfranchise 18-year-olds, right? So obviously, you know, we haven't always been on the forefront of this, but certainly have in modern history. And I think in part that's because after adopting vote by mail, which is, you know, now followed in a number of other states, Colorado and Washington among them, you know, I think Oregon then kind of liked being a leader. And when we came up to 2015, we actually have an organization in our state called the Bus Project, which is a group that was founded in Oregon. They're now in many states, but they essentially have a bus. They bring students, both, you know, kind of just of voting age or just under, and help them be civically engaged, but in a way that's really fun and really, I'm trying to find the right term. Like, you know, it's actually, I'm going to sound like a total nerd here by saying, but it's just cool, right? Like they found a way to make it cool and not, you know, when you see some 16 or 17 year olds at like Model UN, they're in their little suits and they're kind of 16 going on 45.
Right,
well, the bus project
right.
is actually not doing that. They're making it fun and cool for 16 and 17 and 18 and 19 year olds to be engaged.
Yeah. I was in Model UN though. I thought I was cool. Well, are you saying I wasn't when I was Cameroon and Pakistan?
Were you rocking like a nerdy suit with your little red tie?
Look, I didn't dress.
I
didn't
break it to you, man.
There was a portion who would dress like the country, which I think looking back, we might now call appropriation. I would wear maybe a suit. I would be more Western business attire, even if I was, say,
okay.
Kenya or Kazakhstan. Yeah.
Which, yeah, exactly. We would now think that would be the right choice to have made.
Yeah. Yeah. I just lucked into that. So what by what percentage of the vote is this just a straight vote? Would this be amendment to the Constitution? How would it work?
So essentially, it's two steps. One, we have to pass a bill, which is Senate Joint Resolution or SJR 22. That bill then refers the question to the Oregon Constitution, which just requires a simple majority vote. It literally just replaces the words or the number 18 in the Oregon Constitution with the word 16. So we're going to have a hearing on the week of March 25th, which is Oregon's spring break. We're working with a number of students who have helped us introduce this legislation to hopefully mobilize high school students from all over the state. They're organizing what we call it, what they have called a teen takeover day. They're, you know, all rocking it on their Instagram accounts and doing polls. And so we're hoping to really follow their lead and help them be the organizers of this, because people like me who believe in them can tell people all I want that these teens are informed and ready to vote. But them coming up to the Capitol in an organized way and testifying on behalf of themselves is going to do much more showing than I could ever tell.
Yeah. Are you sure the bill is going to come to a vote?
No, I'm not sure. I know that we're going to have a hearing. I think part of the question is, you know, we have received, you asked this earlier, you know, other than kind of the crazy, mean-spirited, immature responses we've gotten on this idea, what are the more reasonable or the responses? And I certainly have had, and I think that question is, do we want it to go to voters at a time when it might fail miserably?
Yeah.
Or do we have maybe some more education to do to get it to a place where when it goes on the ballot, it can pass? Because as you, I think, rightly alluded to, there are certainly people who I wouldn't consider knee-jerk conservatives who are going, you know, 16, God, that just seems really young. And our response to them has been twofold. One, you mentioned the brain science, and I think it's interesting that that gets brought into the conversation. A lot of the responses I've received, both the knee-jerk ones and not, have been, well, their brains aren't developed till they're 25. And actually, the brain science shows that, yes, for hot cognition, which are kind of those impulsive-type decisions, definitely the brain science shows that's happening in the 20s.
Yeah.
But cold cognition, which is the type of decisions that we sit down and make, you know, when we're calm, when we're not in a fight or flight mode, that actually develops fully by the time people are 15 or 16. And the funny thing, Mike, is I learned that from Anna Fields, who wrote an op-ed, and she's 16.
Yeah.
We have looked, there's a couple of countries who have done this. I believe Austria, Netherlands, and Scotland have enfranchised 16 and 17-year-olds for all elections. And the interesting piece is that 16 and 17-year-olds in those countries are actually turning out at a higher rate than 18 to 24-year-olds.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me because they're living at home. They're living at home. They're in a structured environment. They're not off in college or something. It doesn't surprise me at all. They're maybe more excited.
And so the idea, yes, is that at a time when people are living at home, their parents, their teachers, their coaches, their religious leaders, other adults in their lives can help them learn how to do this the same way that we take driver's ed and we learn with somebody to develop, hopefully, a good lifelong habit of voting in every election. Why not get them hooked young for a good habit as opposed to, you know, smoking or drinking or cannabis use, the things that we raise the age for because they're kind of social harms that we have to, you know, manage as a society, but we don't necessarily want people to develop lifelong habits. So we raise the age for those things. This is a good habit that we want people to develop. When you look at these students who are, you know, the generation that's been doing lockdown drills in their schools since they were in kindergarten, here in Oregon, 16-year-olds can be charged as adults for certain crimes. They work, they pay taxes, they can make medical decisions for their own bodies. And then from a climate change standpoint, we have 16 and 17-year-olds today who are living with the decisions that we've made for them that will affect their future in incredibly dramatic ways.
So I'm just thinking about passage again, and it is the structure of your 30-seat chamber. The Senate is 18 Democrat, 12 Republicans, so people from afar might say, oh, no problem getting it through. But the three most senior Democrats, including the president of the Senate, who I believe you're the only vote against, are all septuagenarians, people who've been in politics a long time, and the old system has worked for them. Might there be an age split, if not a partisan split, in terms of embracing this position?
Oh, that's certainly a concern. I mean, that's if we decide that we want it to go on the ballot, that we're ready for it to go on the ballot.
Gotcha.
Oregon is one of the states that has initiative and referendum. And so we have a lot of people that, you know, say strategically, if you want something to happen, but you put it on the ballot just prematurely and it fails, you then set the conversation back a decade. I think we're going to really take a lead from these students in March, and depending on how well the hearing goes, because I expect we'll have a bunch of people, if the crowd that has been the most critical of this is any indication, it will likely be, you know, some folks who are really concerned about their Second Amendment rights, who may come and very inarticulately, you know, present their position. And we may have a number of students here, ideally hundreds of them, who will then come and very articulately, and maybe some of them will actually be saying we shouldn't have the right to vote, but doing that in a very informed, articulate way, lobbying their government. So I think it's really going to depend on how this hearing goes in mid-March.
Although if you set this cause back 10 years, would that be extending the right to vote to six-year-olds, technically?
I have a six-year-old. He'd probably do pretty good.
Yeah. Shamia Fagan is a state senator from Oregon, where she is exploring the idea of allowing 16-year-olds to vote. Thank you so much. Also, I don't want to be premature on this, but listen to her. Perhaps we'll be debuting one of the first state Senate podcasts in America. That could be in the offing.
Capitalizing.
Yeah, capitalizing. Thank you so much, Senator Fagan.
Thank you, Mike. It's been a complete honor. I've been listening to your show for years. I want to give a shout out to Emmy Lou Taylor, my best friend since high school, who turned me on to your show a couple of years ago. She listens religiously. And thanks again for having me. This was so fun.
And And now the spiel, reparations. Let's talk about reparations. Everyone loves talking about reparations, especially white people. Not at all uncomfortable for us to talk about reparations. So the reason that so many people are talking about reparations is that what? Late-term abortion is not sensitive enough an issue? No. It's because reparations have somehow become a presidential issue, which I never thought that I would see. Back a few years ago, Barack Obama dismissed the idea of reparations, rightly so. Here was the argument he made in an interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Quote, as a practical matter, it is hard to think of any society in human history in which a majority population has said that as a consequence of historic wrongs, we are now going to take a big chunk of the nation's resources over a long period of time to make that right. It's hard to find a model in which you can practically administer and sustain political support for those kinds of efforts. Barack Obama went on to say, I'm not so optimistic as to think you would ever be able to garner a majority of the American Congress that would make those kinds of investments above and beyond the kind of investments that could be made in a progressive program for lifting up all people. That's a good answer, I would say. This was the answer Kamala Harris gave to Charlemagne the God.
Well, look, I think that we have got to address that. Again, it's back to the inequities. There, through, you know, look, America has a history of 200 years of slavery. Mm-hmm. We had Jim Crow. We had legal segregation in America. We've got to recognize, back to that earlier point, people aren't starting out on the same base in terms of their ability to succeed. And so we have got to recognize that and give people a lift up.
So, door opened. Add to that Elizabeth Warren's comments to the Washington Post explaining the need to institute, quote, systemic structural changes to support black families. And you get this headline in the Washington Post. Three 2020 Democrats say yes to race-based reparations. By the way, Julian Castro was the third. The New York Times, similar headline, 2020 Democrats embrace race-conscious policies, including reparations. I do not disagree with the headline, because when Warren and Harris were asked, what do you think of reparations? Should we add reparations? They said yes. But then they each proceeded to approach the problem exactly like Barack Obama did when he said no. They proposed broad programs that would help poor communities, and these programs would benefit many, many black people. That, by the way, is not reparations. Those are broad social programs that the Democratic Party has been championing for ages, programs that are often thwarted by Republican majorities in legislatures. The real meaning of reparations, which the candidates want you to hear that they're for, but don't do anything to flesh out, the real meaning is to take the descendants of slaves and to say, here is some money or here are some goods or programs that we should give you as a country because of your race and our history. I happen to think reparations are a bad idea, mostly, I quoted Barack Obama, they're impractical, they're unpopular, I would guess they'd be a death sentence for a Democrat that seriously proposed them, which is why no Democrat is seriously proposing them. Oh, Warren and Harris have good, interesting programs for the poor and the historically discriminated against. They're not reparations. They are not saying, you descend from a slave, here is some restitution money. Reparations in Germany occurred. The German government stole the artwork, stole the money of Jewish people. Here is some of their value back. In 1988, the U.S. Congress voted to give reparations to Japanese people who were interred during World War II, the very people who were interred. There were still tens of thousands of them alive. $1.2 billion was set aside, and $500 million was given the first year, and $400 million the next year, and so on. That's reparations. Nothing like that is being proposed here. Which is good, I say. I simply can't imagine reparations passing. I also can't imagine the specter of like DNA testing to qualify for reparations, arguments over whose family immigrated from Nigeria 50 years ago versus who could trace their lineage back 200 years. I can't imagine the government telling Latino Americans, sorry, not discriminated against enough. I can't imagine them telling Latino people who are black, sorry, your ancestors were brought to this hemisphere as part of the slave trade, but not to America. I can't imagine telling the bottom three quintiles of white society, where the average income is $38,000, that your tax dollars are going in part to the top quintile of Black America, where the average income is $155,000. Now, it's true. The top quintile of Black America, average income there, $155,000. Top quintile of White America, average income there, over $200,000. That's true. It's not fair. It's wrong. But it is impractical and wrongheaded to tell poor white people they have to pay for richer Black people. It's also political suicide. The candidates know all this. That's why they're not proposing actual programs for actual reparations in the sense that the term is actually used. But they are answering the question, do you believe in reparations, with the word yes. They're saying, yes, we do. And here's my broad program to help Black people. Whereas Barack Obama said, no, I don't. And here's my broad program to help Black people. And all that is telling to me. What's it telling me? Well, it tells me, obviously, and this you know, that the candidate's perception of Democratic voters is radically shifting to the left. And it also tells me that no one wants to let an opponent of theirs stake out a position to the left of them. But it's also saying that the candidates we have here don't have the confidence of Barack Obama to match their rhetoric with their programs. Barack Obama knew he was disappointing a lot of Democrats, a lot of people in the Black community, and he was fine with it. Warren and Harris are not. Yes, it's true. They're running as different candidates in a different age, against a different background, versus a different set of opponents. But if they think they're going to win a primary by telling potential voters what they think the voters want to hear and then not match it with actual programs, I actually do think they hurt their chances. I think there might be no repairing that. That's it for today's show. Daniel Schrader and Pierre Bien-Aimé produced The Gist. They want to lower the voting age to 16, but raise the drinking age to 28. These kids and their liquor. TJ Raphael is senior producer of Slate Podcast. She believes in raising the car rental age to 26, but then having a carve out or a donut for 27 and 28 year olds, but then let them renting again at the age of 29. Is she just going by the numbers? She's just crunching the numbers. The Gist, I would bargain away a lower voting age so long as we have an upper voting limit. I'd say 87 or whatever age you are when you turn on CNN, but then lock the door when Don Lemon comes on. Un peru, dat peru, du peru, and thanks for listening.